the needs and the struggles, or let's go with needs, the needs that refugees go through in order for them to access education or to access support can be completely different from anyone else from the LGBTQIS community. We can think of community advisory board. We can establish advisory board that includes refugees. When we hear from them, when we sit with refugees, when we hear their voices and ensure that all the voices of those directly affected are included in this, in the decision making. When we do, for example, if I am I'm a student, I'm here on a student visa and I can't go back to my home country, I need to trust my university that I can go somewhere and they will support me. Legal and immigration support is very important. Maybe the universities can partner with legal aid organizations to offer workshops and trainings. Mental health and counseling services for when I see a refugee or when I talk to a refugee, who can support me to deal with struggles that I'm going through, collaborate with local mental health organizations to offer culturally competent and linguistically appropriate counseling services. And then we talk about academic support and scholarships. When we establish scholarships and financial aid programs specifically for refugees and asylum seekers to ensure that they have access to education without financial barriers. I know that a lot of refugees, they go through, if you are not a protected person or you don't have a permanent residency card, you cannot access certain types of education or financial aid. And that stopped me on a personal level when I moved here from doing my master's, because I couldn't support myself as a refugee, not being able to work and go to university. So I had to postpone my education, put it on hold until I'm able to support myself. And building inclusive culture, we're talking about this since we started, but building inclusive campus culture, provide training for faculty, staff, and students on the unique challenges faced by LGBTQI plus refugees and asylum seekers, collaborating with organizations like Rainbow Refugee. We go to a lot of universities and schools. Last week, I was at Charles Dess Secondary School just to talk about what queer refugees go through and what trans refugees coming from a trans person, what we go through when we move here, and inclusive policy development. We try to, as much as possible, ensure that university policies are inclusive and protective to refugees and newcomers. This includes non-discrimination policies, anti-harassment protocols, and accommodation for religious and cultural practices, and advocate for policies at the local and the national level that supports the rights and well-being of refugees and asylum seekers.
You're listening to Intravene Us here on CJSF Campus Community Radio, 90.1 FM. And we are in the middle of a panel discussion that was recorded on Wednesday, June the 5th, by SFU Public Square, called Queer Voices, Universities as Catalysts for Two SLGBTQIA+ Advocacy and Support. And we will return to that panel now.
Thank you. No, I think it's so important, both university policy and government policy align on this. It's interesting, I remember meeting a barber, actually, who was a refugee, and he said, you know, one of the reasons he came to Canada is when they stamped the passport, they didn't say refugee, they said, you know, like a visitor. So the way that Canada treats people is at that level, at least different than other countries.
And we what we do here in Canada as well, we have a lot of policies. We support refugees way better than other countries, but we still have a lot. We still have room for improvement. We still need to do a lot. I work with refugees at Rainbow Refugee, and sometimes English is not their first language. 99% of them, English is not their first language, and they need to go to schools, but they can't access English classes because they don't have a legal status in the country, because they are still in the process of going to court or proving that they can't go back to their home country. So because they are not protected people in Canada. And this can slow the process of integration in the society and then finding jobs or pursuing education if they want to.
And McKinsey.
Just looping back to something Norma said earlier on in your response about partnering with community organizations that have that expertise and experience with the community on and off campus, is also knowing what your plan is beyond just addressing the direct need that you have. So whether that's a policy or a resource or, you know, hey, we need a training for this group of teachers or professors, knowing is this an urgent plan to address a specific need, but then how are you building this out over years to come? Because oftentimes where we see programs or just general campuses fail is they want to address an urgent need and they check the box and they think that's going to solve it. But this is a larger systemic issue that involves partnership that goes beyond just, you know, a pride presentation or a pride celebration or a policy development. It really goes into a larger equity and diversity strategy that those organizations can be invaluable to support through. So knowing when you approach those community organizations through those partnerships is having that dialogue about, okay, this is the immediate need today, but how can we build this out together to make sure that it's a fruitful partnership that isn't just checking a box?
Great. And Jen and Jude?
Thanks, Kirk. I have been working on refugee newcomers and new Canadians for a number of years. I have done several projects, academic projects. So one of the first things I would say here is that it is possible to make partnerships. So I did it on an individual level. I have an upper division class, which every time I deliver it, I reach out for a real world research project. So through that, I worked with Diversity, which is the Refugee and Settlement Agency in Surrey, through which we were able to prove that the number of settlement services for LGBTQ folks in Surrey was precisely zero. And from that led to Better Together, gave them the justification. So there are ways that you can do these individual partnerships. We can bring it into our curriculum. We can say, here are my grad students and their expertise. We can actually say, what work do you need to be done? But my other thing that my work has shown me over the years is Canada's really, really good at marketing. We market ourselves as this queer-friendly place. Then people come, and as Norma says, they don't necessarily all come as protected persons. A protected person is, for those of you who don't work in the city, is someone who already has the status of a refugee. And they come with the status of being recognised in Canada. But the majority of the people I've spoken to in my work on LGBTQ refugees have been people who have come to Canada on a visa to do some informal work, some short-term work, or on a visa to come and learn English. They are here without the status that gives them any access to things like Work BC to support them finding employment, without any access to things that give them the rights. And often they only know that they can claim protected status is when they find Rainbow Refugee. It's not even when they go to any of the more formalised refugee and settlement agencies. My work is that my research has shown that most of the people who are working in the settlement sector are wonderful. They are so into supporting everybody equally, but they don't have a specific knowledge of the barriers that are faced by refugee and newcomer queer folks. And that doesn't get mentioned. And there's a number of people I've spoken to who said, I didn't know I could claim status until I went to Rainbow Refugee. And by the way, Norma, I have worked on several projects with Sherilyn and Chris Morrissey and various other people. So one of the things I think universities could do here is universities can't say to someone, the government of Canada does not recognise your status, but we'll let you in anyway. So they can't do that directly, but the universities through people like Sherilyn Jordan, can lobby. Academics can lobby for policy change. We can say, you know, we are experts. We have a little bit of authority to claim that kind of thing. And we can lobby for changes. Ideally, it would be changes that would allow people whose status isn't quite regularized just yet to have some aspect of immigration support, guidance, advocacy, whatever. So that's what my work has been finding, is that people come to Canada because Canada seems a safe place to be queer or trans, and yet they don't come with a regularized status, and therefore they hit that problem of they can't access work, they can't access education. What policy I would very much advocate for is to remove the right for employers to require someone to have 500 hours of Canadian work experience. I think that is something that would very much benefit many, many people, not just queer and trans folks, but it often forces people new to Canada to work for nothing to acquire the experience necessary to secure other employment.
Judas, from a student experiencer, anything you want to share?
Yeah, I think being in my role, it's a little bit more, it's a little bit different. I think one thing I've noticed is that the onus is definitely on me. I shouldn't expect students who are already in a precarious situation to educate me. It's a lot of unpaid emotional labor. And so it's on me to educate myself and how things work in the nitty gritty and how I can best support the students. And I think one thing I've really realized is it definitely takes a community. And so through that, it's definitely networking. It's educating myself through certain ways, but also just talking with coworkers. Like I have one coworker specifically who is really knowledgeable on a lot of this stuff. And so a lot of it is me talking to her and asking her questions. And then just through various means, it's kind of like having receipts of who do we talk to? Who is the best person to go through? Who can we kind of not ignore, but what hoops can we jump through to get the best results possible? I think another big way that I support students is also just letting them talk to me, like not being judgmental, meeting them where they're at. And so a lot of the times, they already kind of know that there's only so much like I can do, or it's kind of a waiting game. And so from there, it's not like I'm going to be like, okay, well, you have to wait for you have to wait X amount of time to figure out what's going to happen. And so then, I'm not going to support you. That's not how this works. And so it's just being a listening, being a space of safety and community and just listening. Also, another aspect is definitely, I've had a lot of international students who don't necessarily have the words to talk about their identity, talk about their sexuality or their gender, and they want to know themselves. And so that's also where I come into play is we all come from different places of learning. While I might be from Canada, like growing up in small rural Alberta, I didn't have the lingo that I have now. I didn't come into my gender and sexuality until I was in university. And so I think it can be really detrimental to students when we don't offer that space for learning. And so I think there's a lot of facets to this beyond just kind of on top of what the three people were saying before me. Like I think it's all very complicated but not complicated, and
yeah, it's sort of down to human to human connection, right? Great. I sort of want to go to more of a macro level. So with recent legislative changes in some provinces across Canada impacting queer and trans rights, what strategies can universities employ to advocate for the preservation and advancement of queer rights while resisting regressive measures, both locally and nationally? And maybe I'll start with Norma and then Mackenzie.
Unfortunately, with what we're seeing lately, one thing that universities can do would be official statements and policies. universities can issue clear and strong public statements condemning the regressive measures and affirming the university's commitment to protecting to LGBTQI plus rights, and ensure that university policy explicitly protect the rights and are in compliance with the most progressive legal standards. Lobbying, one thing that we talk that universities can do, active lobby on national level to protect and advance to LGBTQI plus rights. Engage with policymakers to provide expert testimony, research, and data that support the case for to us LGBTQI plus rights. We can talk about definitely inter-university collaborations. Collaborate with universities to create a network that collectively advocate for the rights, share resources and strategies, and coordinate efforts. Establish coalitions that can collectively respond to the changes, and educational campaigns. If universities, if they feel like they want to better support, they can launch educational campaigns that raise awareness about the impact that some people from the community are going through. They can host training programs. They can go to creating probably legal clinics and services for people who are affected to support them better, counseling and mental services. I always talk about mental support because it's very important when we're working with students who are probably affirmed in their gender identity and sexual orientation, or still struggling in a way or another to identify what they're going through. It's very important that they feel safe, they feel seen. It's very important that they can talk to someone who will understand them and probably share the right resources with them, guide them to organizations, guide them to places where they can feel safe. And one thing that we talk about as well is safe reporting mechanisms. Implementing safe and confidential reporting mechanism for instances of discrimination or harassment. Advocating for and ensure that non-discrimination policies are being applied at the university, and making sure that we are listening to the students. We are here to support you. We are here to protect you. And how can we together work on changing some policies to make it better for you?
Awesome. Thank you so much. Mackenzie.
Thank you. When we were talking and looking and seeing everything in the news about the policies and the pronoun policies and everything being introduced, specifically within Saskatchewan, EGAL actually did public polling, and we did some in New Brunswick as well. And we found that only 33% of Canadians personally know someone who is trans, and only 6% have a close relationship with at least one trans person. And that came from our public polling in Saskatchewan after the policy introduction and the talks about the policies. But we also know that when someone does know a trans person, they are less likely to support policies that are harmful towards trans people. And so this is why we really need to focus on representation across the board. We need to listen to stories and experiences, and it's a really important moment for people to educate themselves and turn to organizations who have queer and trans people at the heart and the front of them to understand these issues and be comfortable talking about these topics. There is still such a fear, and understandably so, sometimes with cancel culture and different things, but once we normalize these conversations, once we start talking about them, they become less scary. We've created our Rainbow Action Hub as a part of our Pride initiatives this year. And this highlights actually a lot of, I can't remember the official names we're calling them, but dinner table talks, where, you know, if you're at a family Thanksgiving or anything like that, and a topic around this policy comes up, or a topic about washrooms comes up, or really anything, sex ed comes up, understanding how you can talk about this in a way that isn't too abstract. Like, it really is understandable, and it's not a fearful thing, and it has examples that highlight queer and trans voices. The more people are comfortable talking about these things, my hope is that the misinformation can be eliminated, and some of the violence we're seeing can be lessened. So I think that's so important when we're looking at these challenges and these topics, especially around the pronoun policies, is just understanding what these things are, normalizing them, understanding we all can take action in those conversations. And then, to Norma's point, really knowing where we stand and using our voices to say, you know, this is wrong, this is going to be harmful towards trans and queer students and kids and everyone, really, and making sure that we take a stand.
Maybe Jude and Jen.
I think it's really easy for universities to kind of say that they prioritize EDI and that they're inclusive and that they're for the rights and supporting queer and trans students. But I think it's putting it into practice and actually acting on these in good faith that doesn't always happen. And I think, I mean, I don't want to slander SFU, but also I think there is space for criticism. Because we have encountered some issues with like the name changes and even the pronouns. And so, again, we've out on campus, like we've been able to create some resources. But, you know, even as recent as the end of last semester, I had a student come up and say that with an award ceremony, their dead name was used. And so, and we're kind of right now with all the budget cuts, the people that we used to go to answer to these complaints, to fix, you know, what's happening, they're either no longer here or they're at capacity. And so I think the university is definitely lacking, and I don't think it's able to really stick true to what they're saying and their promises, because just the reality of the situation right now. So it's kind of like, who do we go to? Where do we go? How do we make the university and the institution an accessible space when the institution itself isn't able to do those things or won't? I think a big thing too is kind of there needs to be action when, you know, there are problematic people. I think faculty especially, I've had students bring up problematic faculty, and I think there's definitely a sense where faculty can't kind of be touched, and that they're, because they're at this high level, they're safe from whatever they do. And I think that is a really glaring issue. And again, it's kind of like, if you're saying that you're these things and that you're for the rights and you're supporting queer and trans students, but then when you have people that you employ who are on the opposite of that, and they're actively advocating against those students, then you really need to address that, and you need to follow through again on your promises and what you're saying. Even if that makes you uncomfortable, even if maybe, you know, you don't want to do that. Because again, at the end of the day, you can say all of these things, but until you actually put in the work and you act in good faith, how can queer trans students, staff and faculty really trust you as an institution?
Jen?
Well, everything that's been said is excellent. I would just add that as institutions, we should be not just making statements, but actively engaging and ensuring there is zero tolerance to homophobia and transphobia within our institution. And that the advocacy that we do as an institution goes beyond Pride Month. You know, we get a lot of flag waving, but what happens in December, right? I mean, this is constant. I would also say that, and this doesn't just happen to those of us who happen to be queer or trans, but it happens to any subgroup, you know, people of colour, whatever. It would be lovely if somehow in our equity, diversity and inclusion agenda, we were able to address and recognise the pastoral or emotional work those of us who are the receivers of those conversations that Jude's just been talking about. Right, so in addition to my teaching and research load, I get disclosures from students. I get disclosures of violence, of hatred. I get myself get called incredibly nasty names by others. So I think it would be lovely if we had a way where it was recognised that this isn't just an academic exercise, it's an emotional and pastoral exercise, and that takes a toll, and that it would be really nice to have that included in conversations where we're talking about even just workload or health benefits or whatever. That it's not just down to it, that there's some kind of recognition that this goes beyond happy pride.
No, I think this is such one of the biggest challenges at SFU as well as the whole post-secondary institution. Mm-hmm. And Jude, as you said, is with the budget cuts and everything that's happening, is the resources have just, you know, been dramatically reduced. So how do we address this? You know, so it's a huge challenge for us.
Again, I want to thank SFU Public Square for sharing the audio to the panel we were listening to. If you want to listen to that panel in its entirety, as well as the Q&A that obviously doesn't fit into our limited radio hour, you can find that up on YouTube and follow up on their website, sfu.ca/public square, which I will post in the program notes for this show as well. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming right up.
Neruda is considered one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. A native of Chile who wrote in Spanish, much of his work has been translated into English. Known best for poems of love, he also celebrated nature. His Ode to the Hummingbird brilliantly captures the bird. The poem begins, "The hummingbird in flight is a water spark, an incandescent drop of American fire. The jungle's flaming resume, a heavenly, precise rainbow. The hummingbird is an arc, a golden thread, a green bonfire." Birds were close to Neruda's heart, and his metaphors draw us into the beauty of nature. He composed more than 20 poetic profiles of Chilean birds, including the Andean condor, black-necked swan, rufous-collared sparrow, and Magellanic penguin. One of these poems spoke of how the wandering albatross skims the waves with its great symphonic wings, leaving above the tempest a book that flies on forever, the statue of the wind. Neruda's poetry, too, might be read as a book that flies on forever. For Poetry Month, you can find more poems about birds on our website, birdnote.com. NorthAmericaPublic.org. I'm Michael Stein.
The federal election is on April 28th. Waking up for an early class? That's hard. Voting is easy. You can register and vote on campus from April 13th to 16th. And don't forget to bring accepted ID. Check elections.ca to find out where and when you can vote. Election is on